If you send photographs online or post them on social media, you're likely using what's called JPEGs. If you've seen the amazing photographs of space from the Hubble telescope, you're seeing another use of the same technology behind the JPEG, and I think even behind movies. Well, that technology was discovered by an incredibly talented woman who has won the MacArthur Genius Award, teaches at Duke, and has been named one of L'Oreal's laureates this year, winning a $100,000 grant for her ingenuity in science. Today, you'll meet her, hear about her amazing discovery, and how widely her work is used. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative women, particularly on corporate responsibility, energy, sustainability, and STEM-related issues. I'm Joan Michelson. We talk about innovation, leadership, technologies, and careers, always bringing a new perspective. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts and on greenconnectionsradio.com and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. If you want to gain more insight from women like me and our accomplished guests, join one of our mastermind groups. We'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to save you time and money as you grow your career or your business, no matter what industry you're in. I'd like you to meet Ingrid Dobsche, and she'll probably correct me on the pronunciation of her name, a professor of mathematics at Duke University, the first female tenured professor in mathematics at Duke, in fact, the first woman to receive the National Academy of Sciences Award, and as I said in the introduction, she won the MacArthur Genius Award, and she just received the prestigious L'Oreal Award for Accomplished Women in Science, which is officially called the L'Oreal UNESCO International Award for Women in Science, and she originally hails to us from Belgium. She's discovered what's called the wavelet theory, and that's behind thousands of technologies we have today, including the two that I mentioned. We'll hear her explain it shortly. I'm delighted to talk to Ingrid today because, as many of you know, my great-great-uncle measured the speed of light and was the first scientist from the U.S. to win the Nobel Prize, and his work seems to coordinate with Ingrid's. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, Ingrid, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be on your podcast.
So why don't we start by making sure we're all on the same, well, I guess I have to say wavelength, pardon the pun, but and explain to us what wavelet theory is with some specific examples.
So when you decompose an image into wavelets, what you do corresponds to taking it apart into several different layers that correspond to information that happens in different scales. One way of understanding that is to think of the image and think of blurring it slightly. I mean, when you do that, you have lost some information. And that first layer of information you lose by blurring it is very detailed information. It's the sharpness of the edges and so on. And it's very local. I mean, by blurring, you haven't mixed things in the image that were far apart. And so that little bit of extra information that you had in the sharp image is very localized. And so you can decompose it into very little building blocks that are very localized in the image. Now, if you were to blur that first blur again, then you would again have some information that is lost. But now that's already a little bit less localized. And so by blurring successively, and every time looking at the information you have lost and looking at writing that information in little building blocks, you have a decomposition of your image in the end in a very, very coarse version, very blurry, and then building blocks that go to more and more refined scales and becomes more and more local as you go back to the original resolution. And that is what a wavelet decomposition is. If wherever you are sitting now, you were to take a snapshot of your surroundings, you'll have places where there are sharp edges, and then you have other places where the intensity varies nicely and smoothly. Those are places where you don't need sharp edges.
Oh.
And so that's why you don't waste any energy there when you do this difference of successive blurrings.
Okay, that makes sense. And so give us some examples. I mentioned the Hubble telescope and the JPEG in my introduction. Just give us some examples of where the wavelet theory is being used or has been used?
So with the Hubble telescope, when the Hubble telescope was first launched, they had problems with the optics, I mean, which they later had to repair. So before they did the repairs, they were still trying to get the best out of it they could. And so they would take the blurred images, but since they knew exactly what the mistake was, I mean, they could reconstruct what the optical mistake was, they could try to do the best they could from those blurred data to get back to a better image. And one of the techniques that was used for that, and one of the most successful one, was based on wavelets. Because if you know what it is that deteriorated your image, you can try to do the inverse by having this smart decomposition of the images. But of course, once the Hubble telescope was repaired, there was no need for that anymore. But nevertheless, I mean, if it sends images to Earth and it likes to send those in compressed version, then techniques like JPEG 2000 will do that. And will do that retaining all the places where the sharp edges are, or the sharp features in the astronomical images that it's taking, and not wasting bandwidth or memory width or on places where it's not necessary.
Oh, that's a good point. Okay, that's cool. So it helps you use bandwidth more efficiently too.
Exactly.
One of the things that you and I talked about in preparing for this interview is our shared passion for creativity and innovation. And yes. I'm fascinated that you came up with this. So you had mentioned creativity at work, and I'm curious to understand more about that. What do you mean by creativity at work?
Well, to me, creativity is the ability to connect in often unexpected ways observations or experiences or skills from completely different realms. And it's something that delights me whenever I see it at work. And I find that so many people are so very creative. One of the projects on which I work is using the skills I have in building tools for image analysis to assist art conservators and art curators in questions that pertain to their expertise. And what I then find is that when they see use of something, they say, oh, if you can do that, could you do this? And so on. And that's how so much in research works. You continuously build on what other people have done and make possible, and you say, oh, now that's a cool tool. How could I use that? And we constantly applying it off-label, if you want. And I just enjoy doing and watching that so much.
It reminds me of the innovator's DNA of questioning, connecting, questioning, associating, observing, and experimenting, because you're associating, I do this too, I connect dots that most people don't connect. Mm-hmm. And that's how so many innovations come to be, is to go, well, what if we connected it to this, or what if, you know, seeing patterns like from afar and then experimenting to see what happens if you connect two patterns that weren't connected before, right?
Absolutely. And that's why it can be such fun to work together with other people, because since we all are have our own individual backgrounds, what happens is that we connect dots in different ways. And so you get much more out of a group of engaged people than you get out of every single individual, no matter how bright.
That's great, because that feeds right into my next question. I was going to ask you about collaboration, because
yes,
a collaboration is so critical to breakthroughs, to facilitate uh-huh. breakthroughs. How do you develop a group culture that truly and supports collaboration? I mean, it can be kind of tricky, right? It can get heated sometimes. It can be, you know, people get invested in their own ideas.
Yes.
But also sometimes, you know, the creative spirit takes over and everybody has a different level of what kind of politeness or whatever you might expect, or how they, you know, might operate. I mean, do you set up sort of rules for engagement? I mean, how do you facilitate collaboration and a group culture that supports it?
Postdocs and students I work with see that enthusiasm at work, and they see and how I talk with other people and with them, and interrupting is okay. Unless a person says, please let me finish, and then you let them finish. But having a creative jumping from one to the next and adding on to something that people were just explaining, all that is okay. So it's there is a lot brewing in our meetings. But on the other hand, it doesn't often get heated. I mean, get enthusiastic, but not heated. It's also, I mean, I make very clear to my students that although I like ideas and I like my ideas, I'm not married to them. So as soon as I hear a better idea, I'm very happy to entertain that. Mm-hmm. So I think. And I think that is very important, actually, in a collaboration, that people are willing to listen to others and also to explain to each other, because that's something that I also find. Somebody has an idea and is explaining it in a half-baked way, but somebody else sees a potential in there that might even be beyond what the first person said, and then starts explaining it to others who then see it more because they missed it the first time. And that whole interaction in which value is attached to the ideas that are proposed and they are worked on and changed, and everybody recognizes that it's the group that is building this, and the appreciation of everybody for all the members of the team is, I think, what makes for a good atmosphere in such an endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you definitely need respect. So do you go into these groups or create a group where is it focused? In other words, you say, okay, we're going to get together today to talk about this, or we're trying to solve X, or Sally is trying to, you know, is stuck on Y. I mean, do you have a focal point for the collaboration in a particular?
Often the collaboration is already going, so I have several projects on which we have weekly or bi-weekly meetings where we get together and we discuss and we talk about where we were, and we try to set up an agenda prior to the meeting and that everybody can contribute to. So then it's already started. To start a new collaboration, I mean, and such meetings, often it starts from a serendipitous problem. People who say, oh, look, there's this that we could do. And then I say yes, and I think that would be interesting. And I think, yes, we could contribute something there. And then we try to set up a time that everybody or most of the principals can get together. And the first few times we explain things to each other. So now that I have more experience in this, I often start by saying, look, I thought this would be a good meeting because there's this and this problem, and Nikki and Dan here will explain us about it, and then maybe Barack can explain some approaches he has, and then Wei did some stuff in his thesis that is really a different slant on the same thing. So let's all talk a little bit, and everybody has 10 minutes or so, and after all those 10 minutes, we already know more about what the different expertises are of people. And then there is some free-for-all, and there's some, yes, if I would like to hear more about what you said, and yes, I'd like to, and where can I read about this? And so we grow towards each other. And in a couple of meetings, we usually start defining more detailed goals. So we say, okay, so we got together to discuss this and this and this, and out of our discussions, it has emerged that this particular and that particular thing is of interest to all of us, and it hasn't been solved, so let's try to do something. So even the defining of the goals happens collaboratively, at least in the collaborations that I've been part of.
Oh, I think that's great. That's exactly what I was asking about. So how do you preserve the output? Do you record these? Do you work on a whiteboard that's electronic that you save? I mean, how is the, because sometimes, for me, I would want to go back and you know, once I take what the output is of the meeting and then go and work on something, and then there's a moment where you go, well, wait a minute, how did they put that exactly? You know, and you want to be nice to be able to replay it or look at a graphic of the notes. And when I was at Chrysler, we had electronic whiteboards where we could mind map or brainstorm and put it on a whiteboard, and then it would just push a button and it would end up as a PDF.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and I've seen those too, not in many places because they're not cheap, but what my students now often do is we take pictures of the whiteboard. Before something gets erased, we take a picture, and the pictures get sent around to everybody. Sometimes also one of us takes notes. Sometimes in collaborations that have already started working well, whoever has some results prepares a little presentation about those results and takes notes of all the comments that come.
And oh, yeah, we definitely think you'd want somebody to be taking notes. I mean, I certainly would be, but I'm always taking notes.
So there are many ways in which we keep records, but you're very right. It is something that has to be thought through, and especially at the beginning of a collaboration, I like to set up, the way we do it now is we usually set up a password protected Google Doc to which everybody can contribute, and we use it to set an agenda as well as to say for this question we have now these and these results. And link to other things, so we try to keep track of what we do. So agenda and taking notes and reporting further results is all done through that medium.
Oh, good! I love that. That's important. One of the things you mentioned when we spoke too, which is so important, and you kind of touched on it a minute ago, is the importance of trust in these endeavors. So talk a little bit about building trust in order to drive collaboration and creative.
So indeed, trust is important. And I always, when, depending on the collaboration, people may or may not be very comfortable with sharing all their ideas with people they don't know very well yet, or with this larger group, if they worry about that, then I say, look, I mean, in these discussions, everybody who really contributes to the discussion will be part of the authors of whatever paper comes out. So don't worry about. We just say this group will be part of it.
In academia, you know, you have publishing is very important for one's career.
It is very important. And so that's why I make sure that all the students and postdocs with whom I work do, first of all, get the full chance to contribute. And then if they contribute, get that recognized as by authorship on papers, because it is essential for their further career.
One quick follow-up on this topic, and that is Steve Jobs and other innovators in particular have talked a lot about, and I do, frankly, also, the importance of mixing disciplines.
Yes.
So, you know, he studied calligraphy, for example. He wasn't even an engineer. Do you make a point of bringing in, say, someone from anthropology or the social sciences or some other completely unrelated discipline when you're doing any of this brainstorming?
I don't systematically do that, but it just is so happens that a lot of my work is interdisciplinary. So often in the group of people who are having the meetings, we already have different disciplines represented. So I was saying I do this work together with art conservators and art curators. Now that's a completely different branch.
Oh yeah, that would be. Yeah, I love that idea. Boy, there's a.
I also have collaboration with evolutionary anthropologists or with people who are much closer to the engineering practices of image processing, and I do find it's invigorating to talk with people who have expertise that I do not have and in completely different fields.
I agree, and I'm the same way. How do you know when you've hit upon something that's completely new? Like when you discovered the wavelet theory, for example, I mean, how do you know when something is really new? Because especially in today's world, yes, we have the internet, and yes, you can do a certain amount of searching, and obviously you're abreast of what's going on in your field. But how can you tell, you know, what's your aha moment? I mean, how can you tell?
Well, I don't know. I mean, usually when you're looking for something, you already know a lot and you've asked other people. And so you have already an internal kind of map of that intellectual terrain. And so you can recognize whether something is new and different or not. That's one thing. The other thing is that very often things have a new aspect to them, but they're not completely and utterly new. I mean, they build on a lot of other things. And it's when you have the accumulation of many new pieces that you can see that the whole thing is going into a completely new direction. Also when you have the idea, often the idea has been germinating for a while in your subconscious. Well, at least for me, that's the case. I mean, I actually once, when I was much younger, kept a notebook of all the failed approaches that I had towards solving a problem as a postdoc. And then I did solve that problem eventually, and I wrote a paper. And I really had the impression that it had been a breakthrough, I mean, idea that had made a difference. But then when I looked back in this notebook, I could see that many of the failed ideas had pieces of the right thing in it. So my own notes proved that my recollection of it coming suddenly was not correct. That was I put it all together suddenly, but the different pieces had been there.
Taking those, it reminds me of, there's a quote I've heard that failure is just another step along the line to success, because they all inform us, right? They all leave breadcrumbs to the next step. So I want to pivot to this whole issue of women in STEM. You've been, when you started in your career, the field was even more male dominated than it is today.
Yes.
And as I said, you were the first female tenured professor in math at Duke, but of course you have many that come with you now. But what has it been like for you as a woman in such a highly male-dominated field? And what are some of the shifts that you've seen? I mean, how has your way of navigating that field changed over time?
Well, I'm glad to see that there are more women. I am sorry to see that we are still not more numerous than we are. And that is something that is surprising, because I think for at least a generation now, we have been graduating about 30% of PhDs in mathematics in the States are to women mathematicians, and we don't see that percentage among the faculty in research organizations. I mean, that has remained constant at a much lower level, or has not increased at least, and as much. And so you would have thought that, given that we have been at the 30%. For 25 years, that we would have increased to the higher levels more. So there are other factors at work, and I think we have many theories and anecdotal evidence, but I think it would be good to have some evidence-based studies and ways of improving that, because I think it will be better for the profession if we have a wider representation of underrepresented group, not just women, also minority people. Because indeed, different backgrounds lead to different ways of generating ideas, and it becomes more creative if you have a wider
range. Exactly. You'd have diversity of ideas as well as diversity of experience. That's part of why I was asking about bringing people in from different disciplines. The statistics that I saw from the National Mathematics Survey, by the way, say that only 24% of tenured math professors in the United States are women, and only 11% of full professors in mathematics at PhD granting institutions are women.
That's
preposterous. And yet also said that there were 41% of undergraduates in math are women.
Yes.
And something's falling off. Why do you think women are falling off? They study math in undergraduate, but they don't well, get a PhD?
Or when you look at PhD, it's 30%, and then when you go to faculty, it's 24%, and then when you go to full professors at PhD granting, it's 11%. So you fall off at every step, and I have not done a study about this, nor have I read complete studies that fully explain this. I believe that part of it is that there's a culture problem, and there's a lack of role models. But I mean, that we can remedy. There are a lot of I've heard of a friend who talks about microaggressions. I mean, small little things that you hear and that imply, without speaker realizing it, imply a different attitude towards women in STEM than men. And after a while, you get tired of it. And so I think some young women are more sensitive to that than others. And it's true that with an education in mathematics, you can go into so many different directions that some of them may feel, why should I do this? Why should I stay in these surroundings? Why shouldn't I do something else where all the cleverness and all the skills I have learned also will be appreciated, and I wouldn't be subjected to this? So I believe that there are many different things that play a role, which also means that it's not an immediate thing to solve, but that we should be alert to many different aspects before we can change those numbers.
So one more quick question, a career-oriented question, that before I let you go, what would you suggest to a woman in mid-career? We like to focus on women in mid-career, say, you know, 10 to 15 years of experience, who wants to use her education and her experience to make a difference in her career and in a STEM career, but she also wants to get ahead and make more money, right? I mean, you've done very well in your field. Mm-hmm. Some people want us to be more in the private sector or an NGO or whatever, but what would you suggest to a woman? Is there a way of thinking about making a career decision that you would suggest, for example, or what would you suggest?
What has served me well is to be interested in what mattered to the organization I was part of. So at universities, I'm interested in research. I'm interested in teaching issues. I actually love teaching lower level classes. I mean, unlike some other of my colleagues at Duke, actually, I'm very lucky, and teaching is something that almost all my colleagues take very seriously. But I've been elsewhere where teaching undergraduates who were not going to be professional mathematicians was not something that some of my colleagues enjoyed over much. So I have also looked only for to be at places where I would have where a large part of my job would be issues in which I could be so interested, invested. So I think that's, if it's possible, and I realize that it's not always possible for people, but to find roles in one's organization where you feel interested, feel you can contribute, and then do that with enthusiasm, that's what has worked for me. I realize that not everybody may be in such a position. But I also have learned to know my weaknesses. So management is one of those.
So thank you so much, Ingrid. This has been wonderful. I'm going to ask you to say your last name for me one more time.
Dobshi.
Oh, I was pretty close. That's exciting.
Yes, you were.
Okay, good. So thank you so much for joining us today on Green Connections Radio. Ingrid Dobshi of Duke University and winner of the prestigious L'Oreal UNESCO International Award for Women in Science, among many other awards. And congratulations, Ingrid.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Are you someone who loves math? Are you good at math? What do people tell you about working in the field of mathematics? How might you use it either in the classroom, in a research lab, or in the private sector? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or post it on our Facebook page and like the page while you're there and ask to join our private Facebook group. or email it to us at info@greenconnectionsradio.com. Find us online on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you like to listen to your favorite podcasts, or on our website, greenconnectionsradio.com. And if you want to gain insight from more women like us, join one of our Green Connections Mastermind groups, where we'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to save you time and money as you grow your career or your business, no matter what industry you're in. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Check out some podcasts from one of our new sponsors, about a dozen great shows focused on lifestyle industries on Mouth Media Network, with top brand executives, industry leaders, and innovators in fashion, beauty, travel, real estate, content creation, and even spirituality industries and more. Check out Mouth Media Network, powered by Sennheiser, on iTunes, Google Play, and at mouthmedianetwork.com.